Good morning. Representative Dave Pinto calling to order this meeting, the Workforce, Labor and Economic Development, Finance and Policy Committee. My co-chair is Representative Dave Baker. Welcome to everybody. Sorry to be starting a couple minutes late. We have three bills up today. We're going to start with our minutes as usual. Mr. Chair, are you willing to move approval of minutes from March 10th?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes from yesterday, March 10th, as presented.
Thank you, sir. Any additions or corrections, members, to those minutes? Not seeing any, all in favor of approval of the March 10th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. And the minutes are approved. The first bill was going to be a bill from Chair Cagle. I'm not sure if she's here, though.
She's on her way.
So apparently she is about to come in, so we will get started, though maybe I'll ask, Mr. Greenman, are you willing to just be at the testifier table till Chair Cagle shows up? And I'll have you to start her. Well, apparently her testifiers are here and ready to go, and she's about to walk in is what I'm being told. And we're also waiting for the nonpartisan summary for Representative Greenman's bill. So the reason that's why we're thinking that Chair Cagle is going to walk in and we would get started on her bill. I'm not sure if, either way, I guess Representative Greenman will have you make your way up if you can, I guess. Well, we're waiting for both Chair Cagle and also the summary for your bill, Representative Greenman. All right, why don't we start? We'll start with the Greenman bill then. Apologies, testifier. So Vice Chair Greenman's making her way up to the front, and she moves that House File 2567 be, I believe, placed on the General Register. I believe that's the motion. Or Vice Chair, what is your Judiciary? Okay. Be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary and Civil Law, Finance, and Policy Committee. So again, members, we're taking the second bill first. Vice Chair Greenman, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually have an amendment.
Okay.
There's two amendments. They're sort of drafted as an amendment and amendment to the amendment. They are both involved, and I will let you know I have an amendment. I'm happy to explain them.
Yeah, sure. So it's the A1, which is the underlying amendment, and then you're saying that, the A2 is going to amend that. So first you want to move the A1, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and then we will have you move the A2 as well, then. Okay, and then if you can just describe those two amendments together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are amendments that were some of them were adopted in the Senate, reflecting common sense exceptions to this bill that have been worked out both with stakeholders and also in other states that have been pursuing this. So allowing an exception for credentialed training programs that where someone gets a credential and a mechanism that makes sure that they're fair to the employees. An exemption that would be the amendment to the amendment is an exception that would allow for moving fees and a regime that makes sure that when they are given and agreed to, the repayment structure is fair. It also eliminates DLI's enforcement authority, which eliminates the fiscal note. It brings it in line with the other restrictive covenants, employment covenants, non-competes, no poaches, and shadow non-competes, which we have dealt with, and makes it so that they have the same enforcement regime and also that there's no cost.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Greenman. And these are also amendments that you wish to get the bill in your form, so, in the shape you wish. So, Representative Schultz, you got a question about the
Mr.
amendment?
Mr. Chair, just primarily around process here.
Yes.
Just making sure that we're adopting one amendment at a time and not trying to adopt two at a time.
Well, right. The thing is, though, we would be adopting the A1 as amended. So we had to have the A1 before us in order to adopt the A2. So we have the A2 before us. We're going to adopt that, I guess we'll make a decision about it, and then the A1. So I think so far we've been fine, but thank you. And I'm done being sarcastic towards you, Representative Schultz. Or if I am sarcastic, I'll be very obvious about it. It's also his birthday today, I gather. Oh, but I'm definitely not going to be sarcastic toward you on your birthday, Representative Schultz. So done for multiple reasons. Well, happy birthday to you. Okay, members, any questions about the A2 amendment? That's the one we're going to take first. Then all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. And then the A1 amendment as amended is now before us. Any questions about that one? All in favor of approval of the A1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Then the two, Representative Greenman, House File 2567 as amended is before us. Please present it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2567, right? Okay.
Correct.
Is a bill that prohibits the stay or pay provisions that trap workers into jobs they don't want to be in or they want to leave and forces them either to stay or pay money to their employer as the price of leaving. So what is a stay or pay provision? Imagine you're a pet groomer, you're making minimum wage at PetSmart, and when you want to leave, you tell them you want to leave, they tell you that you owe thousands of dollars for quote-unquote on-the-job training, despite having no training schedules, no consistent training available, and a groomer who was, during that period, doing work for paying customers. Or you're a truck driver who is sexually assaulted while starting your new job and told by your supervisor, without a video, they couldn't do anything. And then when you say, I need to quit my job, the company sends you a bill for $9,000 because of that training repayment assistance program or provision. Or you're a hairstylist who's already has a cosmetology license, and when you want to leave for a better job, you left for a better job after a year was up, you're told you owe $20,000 in back training fees, despite the fact that you went to cosmetology school and paid your own tuition before you got there. So you're a nurse, and you switched jobs between hospitals for better working conditions. 3 years later, you get a letter in the mail saying you still owe the previous hospital $5,000 plus attorney's fees, and it's unclear what training you ever received. You were a nurse before you went to that school. And in nursing, and I think it's indicative to look at nursing like we look at the rest of our economy, these kinds of programs, these traps, as they're called, are increasingly common. Up to 45% of new nurses are bound by these agreements. It's an increasing practice, which also is more common in places where hospital markets are more consolidated. They have a higher level of consolidation, and they have more control over their labor market. Numerous reports suggest that hospitals with higher rates of unsafe working conditions and higher rates of unsafe patients use these agreements, often with payback amounts being between $5,000 and $50,000. The most common type of stay or pay contracts, as I said, are traps, training repayment agreement provisions. They are provisions that force folks into the condition of employment, so when you're signing your contract, and they use threats of debt collection or litigation to lock workers in place and limit their mobility and their bargaining power. And the training in question can oftentimes range from potentially preparation for a recognized credential to very basic company-specific training that is really just about training you on how to do your work that the company wants you to do. So think about the PetSmart or sandwich artist kind of training. And it costs the workers, they have to repay oftentimes completely at the discretion of their employers. High interest rates, attorney's fees, and in some cases, the ability of employers to withhold final paychecks and retirement balances. Now, these kinds of provisions are not new, but they are increasingly growing, especially in low-wage work where folks don't have bargaining power. They are essentially creating a new wave of indentured servitude. These are especially in jobs that are disproportionately held by low-income folks, women, people of color, and as we discussed, you know, nurses, EMTs, retail workers, construction workers, all of these industries we've seen these traps into. It's estimated that now 10% of all U.S. workers are bound by traps, and that's millions of workers in jobs across the country. And like their restrictive covenant cousins, non-competes, shadow non-competes, and no-poach agreements that we have spent a lot of time in this legislature and this committee talking about, these agreements reduce worker mobility and bargaining power and take away people's freedom in the labor market. So if you believe in a free labor market, you believe that one of the things that makes that provides a robust workforce is the ability to go to a different job, the ability to compete, and in some cases where there's high demand, compete for better wages and better working conditions, then traps are a real barrier to that. So these restrict workers, they restrict workers seeking better wages, working conditions, and they limit career trajectory growth, just like when we talked about non-competes. So recently, the FTC estimated that the clauses, that these clauses collectively deprive workers between $250 billion and $296 billion a year. The federal government, the FTC, was actually working on these like non-competes and everything else. They've been challenged by the same folks who probably submitted letters, which are the employers, the increasingly consolidated labor market, who want the power to lock their workers in place so they don't have to pay better wages and they don't have to worry about competing with their competitors. So these are bad for workers. They're bad for competition. They're bad for our markets. Let's end this practice, and I have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. So there's five individuals to testify. If Hannah Ford and Lindsay Lee can make your way to the front. I'm going to ask folks to keep your remarks limited to 2 minutes. I'll try not to cut you off, but if you really can limit yourself to that. We have quite a few people to testify. So do we have our first testifiers making their way up? Hannah Ford and Lindsay Lee? Okay, yeah. And our third testifier is going to be on Zoom, I gather, and so we'll be ready for that. Okay. So, yeah, for our first, if Hannah Ford, if you can, once you get settled in, if you can identify yourself. Yeah. And, again, asking folks to keep yourself just 2 minutes. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Hannah Ford.
You just want to lean right in the microphone.
Hi. Hello. I'm Hannah Ford. I'm a certified lash technician. I do eyelash extensions. Eyelash extensions are pretty similar to hair extensions in that it's just extensions for your eyes. I am certified by the state. I went to school for this. I paid up to $2,000 for a rigorous program to be certified in the state of Minnesota. After I got my state license, I was looking for work. I came across a studio called Deca Lash. At Deca Lash, I started pretty quickly. The onboarding process was very quickly. I was told that I'm signing an agreement to pay for tuition. We didn't really talk about it that much. We didn't really go into detail. I was just told to sign off in order to start working. Once I started, the quote-unquote training started. Training consisted of taking pictures of the work that I had done and sending it to an email chain to their trainer in New Jersey, I believe she was based out of. So there was no one-on-one hands-on training, no learning, no advancement. Their training did not include any additional certificates or I couldn't do anything with their training, no more than what I already had from the state. When I decided to part ways with them because I wasn't earning much money and, like I said, there was no advancement, it just didn't make sense for me to stay. Once I decided to leave, they reached out to me later thereafter stating that I had owed them $3,000 for a training that I did not receive. I wasn't told when I had to pay it back. I was just told that I owed them. That was very overwhelming. $3,000 is a lot of money to pay at one time for something that I didn't get. I felt extremely trapped. I didn't really know what to do with that information or where to turn to. That's why it's super important for bills like the Pay to Stay to be passed to protect employees like me that were pretty blindsided by that.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. I'm sorry you've experienced that, but thanks for sharing it today. Appreciate it. Yeah. And Lindsay Lee, you're up now.
I think I may said the CA. Ms. Lee is here from the AG's office to answer questions if later, but not to testify.
Okay, great. All right, good. Glad to have you. In that case, we'll move to our testifier via Zoom, Chris Hicks. And so if you can please identify yourself once you're up. I'm hoping you can hear us.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yep. And so you've heard the request to keep it to 2 minutes, and please proceed. And do identify yourself at the beginning.
Thank you for the chance to testify today, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Hicks. I'm a senior policy advisor at Protect Borrowers, a nonprofit policy organization focused on household and consumer debt. I'm based in Kansas City, Missouri, where perhaps we're at House File 2567. Increasingly, our investigations, reporting, and litigation have found that employers are requiring workers to pay a fee if they have the audacity to quit their jobs. The most common example are training repayment agreement provisions, better known as TRAPS, which you just heard about. TRAPS put workers on the hook for thousands of dollars in debt to repay employers for their so-called training costs if they leave their job before a fixed period of time. TRAPS let these businesses use the threat of debt collection or litigation to lock workers in place, limiting their mobility and bargaining power and leaving leveraging crushing financial penalties if a worker does dare to leave. Traps gained national attention 3 years ago when a former PetSmart worker sued the company, alleging that PetSmart was trapping workers, often earning minimum wage, in stressful and grueling positions or requiring them to pay $5,000 if they quit. These terms not only block employees from pursuing higher paying jobs, but can prevent workers from leaving to pursue higher education, starting a new business, or even taking care of a loved one. For the vast majority of workers, the threat of debt becomes a form of modern-day indentured servitude, trapping them in jobs with low wages and bad working conditions. In other types of stay-or-pay contracts, employers have demanded that departing employees pay them the cost of their replacement salary, liquidated damages, costs related to immigration, or even lost profits. Immigration and visa fees have used by third-party healthcare staffing agencies and hospitals have come under great scrutiny in particular. Consider the story of Jane Ingen. She started working as a nurse at a skilled nursing facility, and when she did so, she was assigned 20 to 25 patients at a time and spent each shift praying that she wouldn't make mistakes. After 5 months, Ms. Ingen decided that the toll of chronic understaffing was taking on her mental health was too great, so she gave her notice. A week after her final shift, the company sued her for $100,000, claiming breach of contract, fraud, and expenses related to immigration visa and other costs. These nurses are forced to work under conditions that no American wants to work in, and threatened with massive penalties if they try to quit. These contracts create dangerous conditions for Minnesota healthcare patients and line the pockets of companies undercutting American workers. We also see stay-or-pay contracts used in aviation, technology, transportation, among other industries. This bill would protect workers' ability to leave a job without penalty, benefiting workers and honest businesses across Minnesota. I applaud the sponsors and legislator for taking up this issue. Thank you for the chance to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And thanks for your testimony. I appreciate it. If we can have the final two testifiers make your way up, we'll need to have some space made for them up there. You just wait in the front if you can. So Lauren Schotthorst and Dalton Danielson. And so I think, Ms. Schotthorst, you're going to be going first. And so please identify yourself once you are ready and then proceed with your testimony. And again, asking you both to keep it just 2 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business organization representing 6,300 businesses and more than 500,000 employees across the state. A majority of our members are small to mid-sized businesses. The Chamber appreciates the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 2567, legislation seeking to prohibit employees and employers from entering into written agreements or contracts that stipulate an employee pay back an employer a certain sum of money if the employee leaves the employment before the passage of a stated amount of time for certain costs or reimbursements. These types of employee retention mechanisms are fairly common and vary, as you've heard. They include anything from relocation agreements and sign-on bonuses to retention bonuses and tuition reimbursement programs. Beyond that, you'll find employer-supported professional certifications, immigration assistance, and employee loans as opportunities that employers have made available to their employees in exchange for a reasonable term of service. There is nothing unconscionable about this, nor should it be against public policy. It is reasonable to expect a return on this type of discretionary employer investment in employee development, support, and training portfolios. Despite some examples shared today, these agreements, when done properly, can be generally mutually beneficial. A blanket prohibition on these types of agreements, where this bill started, negatively impacts employees, as employers simply won't make these agreements available anymore. We appreciate that the amendment seems to contemplate some exceptions and thank the author for offering it, but it doesn't go nearly far enough or address our issues with the bill to change our position at this time. Industries across Minnesota's diverse economy are experiencing several troubling trends, including high costs and steep increases in regulation and business mandates on workplaces that are already heavily regulated in Minnesota. Minnesota's employers and employees are counting on lawmakers to work towards an agenda for economic growth and making Minnesota's economy stronger, more vibrant, and more viable. Instead of reducing costs or making it easier for Minnesota businesses to remain competitive, this bill takes the opposite approach. Because it will impede Minnesota's business competitiveness, we respectfully encourage a no vote on this bill today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here. And then finally, Mr. Danielson.
Yeah. Good morning, Committee Chair Pinto. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Minnesota Business Partnership, also called MBP, is an association of CEOs and senior executives from Minnesota's most innovative and respected large companies. The partnership represents state, regional, and global leaders in healthcare, med tech, agriculture, financial services, manufacturing, and more. Right now, our members compete nationally and globally for talent. To attract workers, especially into high-skill, high-demand roles, employers often front the cost of training, certifications, onboarding, and even relocation. We do appreciate the A2 amendment from the author, but still have significant concerns about unintended consequences that this may have, particularly line 1.6 on the A2 and the definition of outset of employment. Oftentimes, as someone continues in their career, they may have mid-career opportunities that would open them up to some sort of repayment agreement, whether that be education, relocation from another branch, another area of service into Minnesota. So potentially addressing that moving forward. Overall, the result of this will not be more opportunity, it will be less. And so as we look at investing in our employees, keeping options on the table, and as the Chamber mentioned, when these agreements are agreed to, clear terms, they are useful tools for our employers to attract and retain the best talent here in Minnesota. I will also, for the record, respectfully yet unequivocally disagree that the trap mentioned by testifiers is the standard in these agreements. Our companies take a great deal of care in respecting their employees and creating great workplaces for them. And so these agreements moving forward are important for our businesses. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here. Is there anybody else, member of the public in the room, who wished to testify on the bill? And not seeing any, so we will close testimony and then moving to member discussion and questions. Members. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for bringing a bill that is so fun to discuss this morning on my birthday. It's appreciated. And I just wanted to start by just asking a very broad and simple question. Why would we want the government to insert ourselves into this private contract?
Representative Greenman.
I think what you heard from the employer representatives is about power. They talked about useful tools for employers. They talked about discretionary for the employers. I think anybody here who talks to an employee who is working in a big company, especially a low-wage worker, does not hear about how they have their lawyers negotiating their contracts. These are contracts that are put in front of employees. Oftentimes, you get the minimum wage job or the middle class job, you sign it or you don't. So when we talk about an unequal bargaining power, I think it's incumbent on us to ensure that we're protecting workers and we're protecting employees who don't have the corporate structure and increasingly consolidated corporate structure to demand any term they want and exploit workers and prevent them from leaving their jobs.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, as a reminder to us, we have a relatively low unemployment rate, and we actually have more jobs available in Minnesota than there are employees seeking work right now, which is a good thing. And so I'm curious, just along the same line, how we really need to insert ourselves into this discussion when there are options for employees or seeking work to go to another employer. As has been mentioned, fortunately to this point, we still do have many major businesses, Fortune 500 companies, headquarter economy businesses here in Minnesota, and that gives employees the chance to go find other work, potentially even in their field. I look at this and I'm curious as to why we would need to do this when there is choice in the marketplace today as to where people can work. But switching gears slightly, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman, can you tell us what or what spaces, what industries, or whom was exempted from this bill through your amendments? If you could name them for us, please.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and I want to respond to the first point you made because I think you made my point for me. We have when we have a competitive labor market, what you want to see is people being able to go find another job, them being able to use the benefit of demand to get a better wage, get a better working conditions, and that is good. And these are exactly the reason we need to prevent them, is this prevents that movement on purpose, right? Because it is a way in a competitive work labor environment for employers, especially as we look at consolidation, to keep people from leaving. It's expensive to lose employees, especially when we're talking about people at, you know, your high turnover employers. You hear that all the time. Keeping workers is really expensive. This is actually a great way to do that. If you leave, you have to pay back $5, $10, $15,000. It means that actually leaving to go to somewhere else is, it's not the market deciding, it is an employer's, a provision in employer's contract, much of which, as you've heard, doesn't offer any value. So I appreciate you making that point about why we need to do this. When we talk about and how we created these exceptions, what we were looking for is when you are doing something like an apprenticeship program or a certification program that leads to a credential that is of value to the worker, right? Not a credential that says you're training, PetSmart is training people on how they want you to do their job, or an eyelash technician is being trained on how DecaLash wants to present their company. These are things, an apprenticeship program, a college degree, a certification that you don't go in having that you end up with. Those are all things that are of value to the worker. They're also of value to the employer. And that's why we crafted this, is to say that in those places, it has to be fair. There's a structure of you have to actually have a fair way to repay. A lot of these, if you look at these traps, a lot of what you'll see is that they're not actually based on anything other than what the employer says, $10,000, $5,000, they're a round number. When the exceptions we created are specifically around the places that, that workers and that the economy is set are of value and leave employees with value, not just discretionary tools and useful tools for employers.
Representative Schultz, back to you.
Would be benefiting from the exception to this rule, and who would not, because my understanding is it might not be as blanket of an approach as you might suggest.
Well, I think it does say apprenticeship program in the amendment. Representative Greenman?
Yep, apprenticeship programs and related to the repayment of tuition for transferable credentials. As I said, these are credentials that actually have value to the employee in the workplace, not just value to the employer about how they want you to do the job or to keep you there and trapped.
Representative Schultz, anything
just seeking further? Specific examples for that, Mr. Chair. That's what I'm seeking.
Specific examples of apprenticeship programs?
Examples of, yes. Yeah, that's what I'm seeking, the examples of those who would be excluded from this law versus those who are not excluded.
Okay, Representative Greenman, I'll let you, before we move on to another
I feel like
question.
You're asking me for a counterfactual. I can read you the exclusion, the exceptions. And again, if you are in a registered apprenticeship program, if you are, if it is agreement related to the repayment of tuition for a transferable credit and credentials, and it meets the agreements, that the reasonable agreements, those are all, I mean, we're talking about economy-wide provisions, and that's part of why we, if you heard from the testifiers, it's in aviation, it's in construction, it's in the service industry. There's actually a great packet, a great report, and if you look in your packet, there's dozens of examples. There's a line, I didn't bring it with me, that looks at the average trap in some of these industries. And so I think that what I'm struggling with is, like, if you want me to, it's not an industry-specific exclusion. It is about the kinds of training that is provided to the benefit of the worker
And sometimes that's transferable credit. Sometimes that is also apprenticeship programs. But it's a pretty broad set of things. What it is designed to do is say they are credentials that are worth it for the employee.
So we have four more questioners on the list, so we'll keep moving, and we've got a lot to do today. So I'll just ask folks if you can keep the questions as short as possible. We're up in agreement if you're able to as well, but of course there's a lot of meat here. Chair Baker, to you.
Thank you for this. I guess Representative Greenman, I've used something like this before when I want to invest in somebody who I really have a lot of hope in my industry. There's contracts every day that happen in our business world, and these are basically, you know, set up as kind of a trust foundation. If I want to invest in somebody's training or certification, again, I think it sounds like you say that that's kind of set aside. But are these agreements that you're talking about, are they legal documents? Are they when you're saying they're being trapped, are the contracts written illegally where they've not been vetted to say, if you do leave early after this investment, you owe us X amount? Are you suggesting today from your testifiers that they were duped, were lied to in a contract? Did they not sign something that they understood? What about this contract that we all live and die with loans and things that we buy and our student loans? I mean, are those agreements legit?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Baker. This actually allows me to make a really important point that we talked about when we talked about non-competes as well. There is a whole jurisprudence about unconscionable contracts, right? There are contracts where the bargaining power is unequal. There's lots of non-competes that were determined to be unenforceable. They were in people's contracts, and when the court saw them, they were unenforceable. The problem with that, especially for folks, most folks don't have a lawyer, is that you actually don't know that they're unconscionable until you go to court. And so one of the things, there's probably a lot of these that are that may be legal. There are also many that are probably not. And it's all, there's a balancing test. What we're trying to do is say, give some power to the workers who are oftentimes signing contracts, right? 14 points. And again, if you can look at some of the contracts in your packet, 14, 15, 16 page documents, right, that are the take it or leave it. And most workers, I mean, I had to become a lawyer before I had a contract that I actually had some negotiation in. And so they are, again, as we heard, they are useful tools for employers. But if you have unequal bargaining power, which is in a lot of cases more and more what we're talking about, if you have unequal bargaining power, it is our job and it's incumbent on us to make sure that we are creating a structure that works for everybody. And right now, we don't have that in our economy.
Chair Baker.
Real quick.
Yeah.
And again, I'm going to keep it short, too. One other thing comes to mind is, have you approached the sort of our military side of things, like the National Guard? They invest heavily into training, specialty things like electricians and engineering. They sign agreements that they can't leave early. So how does this work, your idea of protecting them when we invest heavily in them with whether it's a certification or not, but it's intense training from our military? How does this affect, in your thoughts, have you talked with the National Guard about how this idea of yours would affect their ranks?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware, and this will be helpful, this is going to judiciary, so we have some time, of contracts that require, and you may know better than me, require National Guardsmen to pay back their training. And if that's true, then we should have that conversation. This is not something that has come up, and I don't know if the Attorney General's folks are there in the conversations. And so I'm happy to have that conversation specifically as it relates to the U.S. government and the state government. It is not something that has been raised since. So,
Chair Baker, anything?
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, sure. For me, this is a very hard bill to support today, even to move it on to somewhere else. This is, again, anti-growth. This is going to hurt many more employees than help it. I think you're trying to get to something that is maybe a couple situations. And, again, your testifiers, I'm sure, maybe were wrong. But overall, this is not going to be helpful for private employers like myself or others to invest in promising young people, either their own internal training programs or agreements that we have. This I think is going to do more damage than good. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Lesnikar. You'll pass. Okay. And then I'll ask Representative Frazier and Johnson if you keep it very short if you can. But Chair Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ford.
Yeah.
First of all, your lashes. I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. I think when you testified, you stated that you paid $2,000 for your certification. Is that correct?
Through the state, yes.
Okay, through the state. Then when you got the job with your employer, you were given an agreement to pay $3,000, another $3,000. And what was that $3,000 for?
Ms. Ford.
For training.
And what was that training?
There was no training. It was to take pictures and to send those pictures to an email chain to their trainer who is in New Jersey. So I never met her in person. She never saw my work in person. She didn't touch my lashes. It was just a picture.
So you didn't learn anything new from that?
No.
Ms. Ford. And Chair Frazier.
And then you were required to pay back that $3,000?
Yes.
Ms. Ford. Chair Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ford, for confirming what I thought I heard. I don't know how that's fair.
Me either.
And I think that's what this conversation is about. It is about fairness. It is about the unequal balance of power that employers have. Someone's looking for employment. You've got your certification. You've done the things you've been asked to do. You paid for those things. And now you're being asked to pay more than the certification itself. And you're not picking up a new skill. And you're being told if you leave, you have to pay that back.
Correct.
This is about fairness. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. Representative Johnson, very quick.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. A similar point. I just, to try and help clarify Representative Schultz's question, the difference when he asked about leaving with something and what you're exempting, in Ms. Ford's case is a perfect example. She on her own went and got a state certificate, state licensure, then went to this employer and used that skill that she paid for and then left, and they tried to charge her for something else. Now, if this was different where she came in with zero experience and that business paid her to get the state licensure, then with your amendment, they in theory could come back and get that because it is a transferable benefit that she can take on to other places where she came in with nothing, got a certificate that is recognized not just by one company but by the state, and then she could use that to build a business, she could use that to move on. But that's not the case here. So I just try and give a real-world example of a testifier we have in how that amendment would change things.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And Representative Bakeberg, very quick.
Very quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the A1 amendment, line 1.17, and then I'm also looking at the underlying bill for the definitions. So I see it, and I think this goes into Representative Johnson and Representative Frazier, the term transferable credit. I don't see a definition for transferable credit, so I think that's adding to confusion and, frankly, concern from my perspective. So can you define what transferable credit is?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we took this from a set of other states who have been working on this. I think that it says transferable credential. And what that means, I think, is a credential or license. I think if you're interested, we could absolutely, I'm for definitions, add a definition, or if there is an opportunity to just cross-reference. The point is, and I think that this is what both Ms. Ford and Representative Frazier make, is getting something, a credential, a license, a degree that then allows you to take it somewhere else, that is a value to both the employer and employee. And that's why it's a transferable credential. And I think transferable is the key word.
Okay. Hopefully that covers it, Representative Bakeberg.
Quickly. Thank you. I should have read it quicker or closer, but I think that's the definitions matter. Yesterday when I met with AFSCME, we talked about a number of topics, and that was one of the key things that we talked about, that definitions matter. So we need to have it right before we pass legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And the Representative Greenman, if you can keep it very short in your closing.
Thank you. And I think all I will say is this is about a level playing field. This is about ensuring that workers actually have the ability to take advantage of the competitive labor market that you mentioned, Representative Schultz, that they have the advantage to gain skills on the job that they can take other places. Instead, what these stay or pay provisions do is the exact opposite. They give more power to the employers, they prevent people from leaving, and they
interrupt the freedom of the labor market. So with that, Mr. Chair, this is an easy one, like banning non-competes and like banning all the restrictive covenants. This is something we should do for, there's a lot more employees out there than there are employers. And this is actually, with the amendments, a really good compromise. It allows the employers to invest and incentivize while making sure that it's fair for the employees.
Representative Schultz, you have a process question?
Just asking for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There will be one. Representative Greenman renews her motion on House File 2567 as amended. Just verifying the bill number. Yep, as amended. Be recommended for your referral to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pinto?
Aye.
Chair Pinto, aye. Chair Baker?
Baker, no.
Baker, no. Rep Greenman?
Aye.
Rep Greenman, aye. Rep Mecklen? Rep Mecklen, no. Rep Bakeberg?
No.
Rep Bakeberg, no. Rep Berg?
Aye.
Rep Berg, aye. Rep Frazier?
Aye.
Rep Frazier, aye. Rep Hussein?
Aye.
Rep Hussein, aye. Rep Pete Johnson?
Aye.
Rep Pete Johnson, aye. Rep Wayne Johnson?
No.
Rep Wayne Johnson, no. Rep Kozlowski?
Aye.
Rep Kozlowski, aye. Rep Mueller? Rep Mueller votes no. Rep Schultz?
No.
Rep Schultz, no. Rep Zelensikar?
Zelensikar, no.
Rep Zelensikar, no.
And there are, I believe, seven ayes and seven nays. Is that correct, Madam Clerk?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. And so with that, the motion does not prevail. Thank you all for the discussion. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for presenting the bill. Ms. Ford, thanks especially to you for sharing your testimony, your experience. So Representative Cagle is making her way to the front of the room. Vice Chair Greenman moves that House File 3889 be brought before the committee. We are a bit behind schedule, and so I'll ask this bill will it's going to be laid over. Representative Cagle, if you can present, and then if you're two testifiers, yeah, make your way on up. And we're going to ask you each to keep it to 2 minutes. Piece. Representative Cagle.
Mr. Chair, members. This is a easy bill. This is a grant program for folks that are low income for general maintenance of their vehicles, low-cost repair programs. I worked at a CAP agency here in Ramsey County, and we had a loan program for low-income individuals. Helps build their credit and then gets them a reliable vehicle for them to be able to get to their job. It was really, for me, I loved seeing the people come in every month and see the pride in them paying off their car loan and building that credit. And so this is a program that I think I've sponsored almost every year I've been here. And it's a great program. And so with that, I'll leave it over to my testifiers, Ms. Odegaard.
Yeah, sounds good. And I'll point out, members, we've got a report, annual report in our packet, and members of the public, that's online along with all the other materials from the hearing as well. So it looks like we're going to have Jonathan Marchand go first. If you can just please keep your remarks to 2 minutes and identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would defer the opening comments to Ms. Odegaard.
Okay. Ms. Odegaard, welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm here as a volunteer advocate on behalf of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. In 2017, the legislature first made an appropriation for a little pilot program called Getting to Work to help people who needed a working vehicle to find or keep a job. The pilot showed really good results for participants' employment status and earnings. So the pilot was the program was officially established in 2022 and has grown from 62 participants in that year to over 800 in 2025. The most recent deed report, as the chair just mentioned, is in your packets. I want to make sure you look at pages 4 and 5, which lists the 12 organizations that received funding in the last grant round and the 51 counties altogether served by these grants, so you can see how the benefits of the program affected communities in your district. Grants are made to nonprofit organizations that offer car repairs or car loans or donated vehicles to low-income folks who are over 18 years old, have a valid driver's license and insurance, and who can demonstrate they need that vehicle to find or keep a job. The funding also supports programming for those participants like financial literacy or credit building or vehicle maintenance and repair, which helps families build and maintain independence. Organizations receiving these grants are required to leverage at least 50% of the award amount as matching funds from other sources to make sure these dollars are stretched as far as possible. Making sure that someone has a safe working vehicle to find or keep a job primarily helps that family, but it goes a lot further than that.
It helps employers who benefit when their employees have reliable transportation. It helps people rely less on other public support resources when they can maintain their own earned income. And most of the dollars go right back to small businesses in the community. I was recently talking to the coordinator of the Getting to Work program at TriCap in the St. Cloud area, and she told me they partner with local mechanics who compete through an RFP process to be one of the trusted providers for vehicle repairs for their participants. It's a win-win situation. The participant gets fast, reliable service so they can get back to their job, and it's a reliable source of work and fair payment for the mechanic shop, who also gets the satisfaction of knowing they're supporting their neighbors and a stronger community. If one of these programs is in your district and you haven't visited them, you really should get out there. I've been to most of these programs over the years, and folks there are passionate about helping families get back on their feet. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. We'll move to the other testifier. If you can please identify yourself and proceed.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jonathan Marchand. I am a community services manager with United Community Action Partnership. We work in a 9-county area of rural Minnesota that is encompassed by economic development regions 6, E, 8, and 9. And we have some service overlap within Pipestone, Nobles, and Rock County as well. During the most recent fiscal year of our Getting to Work program, we were able to assist 125 different participants with either vehicle purchases or repair assistance in order for them to get to work. That was an incredible success rate for us. There is a rigorous screening for eligibility, so we make sure that everybody that's going to be participating does indeed meet the minimum criteria. There is documentation to back up those participants. And when you look at the rural area that we're at, you know, it's on average, you're looking at a sometimes a half-hour commute from home to work. Rural Minnesota is a little quaint where we get to measure distance and time still. But when you look at the workforce support that we had with this, a lot of our folks are still working low-wage jobs, not quite meeting that living wage. And when times are tight, we often look at how do we cut costs. A lot of that is deferred maintenance of vehicles until it's a point where it really takes a large amount of repair. We were able to contribute funds towards those households to match their own funds to repair their vehicle or purchase a vehicle, and it got them to work and sustained their employment and kept our rural areas still as a vibrant economic area. So thank you very much for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else in the public wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, so we'll close testimony. Member discussion and questions, and Chair Baker, you're up first, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for coming. Good to see you, John. You know, and John is from my district. He works really hard on this program. I know firsthand this is a good one. Representative Cagle, can you tell me, we had the checkbook open last year. Why didn't we hear this maybe then, or did we just not get enough? Can you give me some background? We don't have those funds like we had before. Maybe Anna can take this too, but why are we here this year when it's a little bit more challenging for us to find the dollars to do this?
Sure, Cagle, or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we funded it in 2023, but the need is really, you know, there's a huge need out there for this program. And I really look at this as an investment, because we know that when people have good jobs, then they're paying their taxes and they're generating more, you know, wealth in their communities. And so, you know, I think it's really just the need for this program has grown, and we want to make sure that we're investing in our folks so that we can, you know, help them, give them a hand up and help them, you know, get out of, you know, work their way up into middle income and.
Yep.
I think Chair Baker, yeah. I think you're sort of asking.
Well, just and again,
last year, Chair Baker.
It's all about the program. It's good. It's just I wish we were here last year when we had an easier time maybe to find some dollars. But that's beyond the point. My last question, Mr. Chair,
Baker.
Maybe to Mr. Marchand. When you hand over the keys to somebody, I bet that's a great feeling. Do you have them? I mean, is there an agreement that you ask from them to say you have to have a job? You can't go sell the car in a week. Is there some kind of an agreement? A contract, because we're talking about contracts today. This is important for me to understand. When you do something like this for somebody to give them a hand up, are there stipulations with that?
Mr. Marchand.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. When we are working with consumers, and especially those that are receiving a vehicle from us, say from our Helping People Get There program, they sign what is called a charitable interest lien. And that says that they cannot sell the vehicle for a period of 1 year. And they sign that that contract. It goes into their file, and there's also a stipulation that if the vehicle is ever involved in any sort of illegal activity, or if they have a serious moving violation, like a driving one impaired, that vehicle is taken back by the agency. Knock on wood, I've never had to actually enforce that provision. But our consumers understand that, and you know, at the period of 1 year, the asset is truly theirs. If they want to continue to repair it and keep it, kind of depending on the quality of the vehicle, they certainly may. If they use it as an asset towards trading up towards a little higher quality vehicle, that's also an option for them. But yes, to answer your question, there is an agreement in writing with the consumer that says that for that period of a year, you need to retain this vehicle.
So, Chair Baker, final. If they did sell it in 3 months, do you have any reclaim to that? Are you just out? Is there an attorney you're going to go to get the car? Tell me, because we're talking about that today in this committee. What is your ability to protect yourself and the donations and the state dollars that we're asking for to protect those kind of things from people that are not going to follow the rules and in the agreements that they send into?
Mr. Marchand.
Mr. Chair, a very, very good question. We really rely on just kind of maintain contact with the consumer, checking in at 6 months, checking in at 8 and 10 and 12, and saying how is work going. And this is a longitudinal, you know, period of contact with them, and determining if they have, you know, indeed sold that asset. I've never found myself in a position to have to take that back. So we are really just in a period, you know, a position of just establishing where they're at with their employment, and making sure that they have the resources that they need. But I do understand your position, and I see
thank
where
you,
they're
Mr. Chair Baker. Thank you, Mr. Marchand. Again, it's about the discussions today about agreements and should we follow through with them. And this is a great program. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I support it. I don't think you could do the program like you're doing it without that kind of an agreement. So I hope that folks aren't trying to change the whole rules and the whole bill and the whole concept because we might have a couple of bad players out there. So, Brent, appreciate this and thank you for the discussion.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cagle and the testifiers. I've been reviewing this report, which is helpful for us. First off, the question would be, under the legislative history of this program, it says that this could provide for an individual to receive a new motor vehicle by gift, sale, or lease. Question would be, have any new vehicles been given to participants of this program?
Ms. Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know in our CAP agency, there was a cap of how much they could borrow. So it was at that time, which was a while ago, $6,000. And so if they could find a brand new vehicle for $6,000, I'm sure that would be on the table, but maybe I'll hand it over to one of my testifiers.
Yeah, and we do need to keep things moving, so we keep the answer pretty short if you can't. Either of you know, Mr. Marchand or Mr. Ms. Odegaard, answer to the question? Ms. Odegaard, maybe, or Mr. Marchand, okay.
Very good. Mr. Chair, Mr. Schultz, the vehicles that I can speak for United Committee of the Action are gently used vehicles. For a while, our bread and butter were kind of the late 90s, early 2000s Buicks that... You know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Cheap to maintain, reliable vehicles, good mileage that gets people to work. But those are the vehicles that we receive on donation. We recondition and repair.
Okay. Sounds like the answer is no, then, in terms
exactly.
of...
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then the next question, just simply based upon the report, is to, like, look at the results of this program and to scrutinize them effectively. And what I mean by that is... In a lot of instances, as you review the reports from the different issue or from the different regions across the state, you will see that on average, as you look through the report, you see that about half of the people served exited the program to job placement. And I'm curious for us as we consider this program, if that is a metric that the legislature would support, and anything you want to add to that to just kind of help us understand if we are truly achieving the mission as designed by the statute.
Chair Cagle or Ms. Odegaard, not sure who wants to answer that. Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that's up to the legislature on what metrics we want measured. And so if that's something that, you know, we want to look at and see the long-term effect of this program, I think that would be very welcome, because one of the issues that I've seen around here in my 10 years is that we only look at these programs as like upfront capital, and we don't look at the long-term effects of them and how much money that we actually make from these programs, as far as, you know, making sure that we're elevating people, getting them into living wages, providing that, you know, making sure that they have the ability to own a home or, you know, live out their American dream. And, you know, and that's what the American dream is, you know, own a home, have a picket fence, a car, family. And, you know, right now that's just kind of the deck stacked against the workers. And so, you know, really anything we can do to give them a hand up is going to be good.
Good. We really do need to wrap up. So, Representative Schultz, maybe you can connect with the agency and with Chair Cagle further about those program outcomes. And just one note that I want to provide is this feels like a great example of a program where there's a clear legislative goal. Chair Baker and I have been talking a lot about program structure. I know that grant structure, we have a clear goal. Funds get out. We have a report. We can look at it, as Representative Schultz is saying, to see then how the program is working. And that seems like a good thing to do. We'll have to see what funds there are, but certainly the goal here is great, and we'll dive some more into the details. So, Chair Cagle, to your bill to wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great program. You know, I want to kind of go back to Representative Baker's point about the contract that these people are entering into. I think the difference here between something like this and the bill that Representative Greenman was talking about is the transparency in the language. When people sign these contracts with these CAP agencies, they actually know what they're signing. And these guys make it very clear what is expected of them. And so I think that's just, you know, they want to make sure that their clients succeed, where, you know, we just need to make sure that we have as much transparency built into the system. And so with that, I really appreciate, you know, hearing this bill. It's a wonderful program that means a lot to my heart. And I hope somebody will carry the mantle when I leave. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thanks to your testifiers. The chair lays over House File 3889 for possible inclusion in the budget bill. I'll ask Representative Berg to make her way to the front. I think Representative Hussein may be joining you. And Representative Berg moves House File 3878 to bring that before the committee. I don't believe, actually, there is an amendment, and I believe it is your amendment, Representative Berg. And so Representative Berg moves the A2 amendment. It looks pretty technical. Representative Berg, A2 amendment is a technical amendment to clean
up. Yes, Mr. Chair, it just moves the authority to the MAC out of DLI.
Okay, thank you. Members, any discussion on the A2? All in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. There we go. So we have House File 3878 as amended before us. Representative Berg, to your bill. And we'll try to keep things moving and fit all this in. Representative Berg.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is consistently ranked among the best airports in the country. That reputation is built on the workers who clean the terminals late at night, assist passengers, prepare food, and keep the airport running every day. These are the workers that make my job possible. Yet the reality for many of those workers is different from the prestige we celebrate. Many of the people who power MSP, largely black and brown, immigrant, and working class Minnesotans, still struggle because they lack access to affordable health care. Too many are forced to make impossible choices between paying rent, covering bills, or simply seeing a doctor. At the same time, the airline industry, including Delta Airlines, benefits from significant federal and state subsidies, and our airport infrastructure itself is supported with public investment. One example, Minnesota's jet fuel tax subsidy cost Minnesotans $37.4 million in 2024. Delta received $23.6 million of that tax subsidy. The airport is operated by the Metropolitan Airports Commission, or the MAC, a powerful public authority that rightly takes pride in the national awards and recognition MSP receives. But behind the prestige are workers who often work multiple jobs and still cannot afford the benefits that would allow them to care for themselves and their families. These workers have been patient. For years, they have tried to raise these issues directly with the airport leadership, but meaningful action has not followed, and promises to these workers have been broken. Some of these very workers have even been wrongfully detained at the airport or on their way to work during Operation Metro Surge. Bear in mind, anyone who works at the airport in any capacity has been thoroughly vetted by the United States government. So this bill ties compensation to airport service workers to establish federal standards under the McNamara-O'Hara Service Act, ensuring that wages and benefits reflect similar work. Representative Hussein may have a few remarks. Otherwise, we'll go to testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative Hussein.
Thank you for allowing me to support this bill. Many of my community works at the airport, and as you see, a lot of workers not only does the cleaning, but, you know, they are every sector at the airport. And the reason that we have one of the best airport because those community are day and night working to make sure that this airport run efficiently. So please, let's go support this bill and look forward to answer some of the questions.
Thank you, Representative Hussein. So I'll ask the first couple of testifiers to make your way up. And as each person in the list finishes, if the next person up can make their way up so we can keep things moving. So I've got Mizrak and Bessie, and I understand that the second testifier has been substituted. Dawit Melis will be testifying instead of Milad Saeed. And my apologies if I'm mispronouncing some names there. And maybe others can make your way up even to the chairs to be ready to go. Tekliab and Adil Becker, and again, my apologies for mispronouncing your names. So we'll start off Mizrak and Bessie, if you can please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. My name is...
Yeah, let's get the microphone. Yeah, good. Perfect. Right into that microphone.
My name is Mizrak and Bessie. You read it correctly. Thank you.
Good.
And I'm a passenger service assistant at the Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport. I've been working for the last 17 years, and I'm a member of the executive board of my... CIU Local 26.
And one second, I'm going to ask Representative Berg to tilt the microphone, help tilt maybe the tip, right, so it's right by your mouth. Okay. Yeah, and then lean forward a little bit too. Just want to make sure we can hear what you have to say. Okay.
How about now?
Thank you. That's better. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So I've been working for the last 17 years, and I'm a member of the executive board of SEIU Local 26. Every day, I make sure passengers who have trouble getting around the airport are able to get to and from their planes in time. My co-workers do the same and also drive carts, clean the aircrafts, and more. I've been pushing for improvement for the workers who keep the airport running because everything is expensive. As we know, rent is expensive, food is expensive, but we hear how much the airport makes, how much money the airport makes, but we don't get nothing out of it. People are forced to have roommates to be able to afford their rent, but the airport wins awards to make that much money, while we are not sharing this. So we are also facing healthcare crisis at this time because many workers have lost their healthcare from the government, the affordable healthcare from government, but no access now. So some of my co-workers are forced to go out of the country to find a cheaper health service because it's not possible to afford it here. So we have tried to get the airport and our employees to do right, but they keep saying, no, we need your help or we are going to lose good employees and that will hurt the airport that all Minnesotans use for our travel. You can help us. We know other airports have done this and it has helped make sure good people are working to support passengers and that workers can provide for ourselves and our families. Please stand with the Minneapolis Airport workers who are trying to ensure that our airport can work, can continue to thrive. Thank you.
And thank you for coming here, and thanks for sharing your testimony. We appreciate it. As we have the second testifier begin, if we can have the third testifier make your way up to the other seat. And please, to the second testifier, if you can please identify yourself and proceed. And yeah, make sure you get right into that microphone. Thank you.
I'm ready. Okay, my name is David Melles. I'm working at Lesji Sky Chief the last 20 years in the hard weather.
Can we help get you right in there? You want to get the tip right? Yeah, lean right next to that microphone.
Yeah, I'm working in LSG SkyTeam the last 20 years, outside, high temperature, freezing rain, a lot of weathers outside. So I'm operating the high lift trucks. I have to deliver the food on time. The job was by itself, I have to be rushing. So I need insurance for that reason, because something happened, there is no way to protect yourself, because sometimes you don't know what's, the problem is worker on the job or not. So many of our workers or co-workers, they don't have insurance down there. They try to apply for the government insurance because they can't afford it. The company has like 65 by 35 coverage. So you have to pay 35% of your insurance. So when you go doctor, the bill is high. We can't cover it. I'm scared of going by myself to the doctor even. When I go to the doctor the next day, I got big bills. So I scared for that. I never go to doctors. So many reasons we address this issue for Delta, for Mac. Personally, I was there to address my problems. So everybody's ignored it. Still, we are fighting. We are trying to deliver our address. The problem, we need affordable health insurance. We protect the airport. We work hard there. So nobody, we are neglected people. We are suffering. We need desperately the help from you guys. That's why I'm here. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you so much for being here. If you have the next two testifiers, make your way up to the seats. And then whoever's going to be going next, once you settle in, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. If you can make sure to keep your voice up and get right into that microphone, make sure people can hear you. Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Adil Bakar. I was a former employee for SkyShift. I'm currently working as organizer and have free health care. But I'm speaking on behalf of my behalf of the worker who don't. For the past 7 years, employee at Elise SkyShift have been fighting for fair and affordable health care. We are still fighting for it today. Unfortunately, more than half of the company employees do not have health insurance because it is too expensive. Employee currently paid about $300 a month for individual coverage and over $500 a month for family coverage. Because of the high cost, many workers cannot afford insurance and are afraid to go to the doctor when they need to medical care. We are asking the company to provide truly affordable health insurance so that employees and their family and can access what they need. Delta runs this airport, MAC permitting ICE agent to be inside security of the airport. Over dozens of our union members were detained after they passed through security on the way to work. If Delta won't pressure MAC or federal government, we think ICE will not have had much access. Likewise, we think if Delta will push MAC to pass ordinance to provide affordable health care, we wouldn't be here to ask lawmakers to pass law of affordable insurance care, affordable health care. Also, Delta contracts a SkyShift. Delta could also demand that SkyShift provide affordable health care, the workers that care every single one of Delta flight. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here. And as you step away, if you have the next testifier make your way up, and then please, if you can proceed with your testimony, identify yourself.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair and members of this committee. My name is Ayala Taklab, and I have been working at MSP International Airport as a cart driver for over 14 years. and I am a proud member of SEIU Local 26. Our union has over 1,000 workers at MSP, the majority of whom are immigrants, who assist passengers and airlines as car drivers, airplane cleaners, wheelchair agents, bag runners, and many more. We keep things moving smoothly to help all of you get where you are going, ensure MSP can win all the awards they win. And we also help to make all the massive profits for the airlines operating here at MSP International Airport. But we are here today because we employees aren't getting what we deserve. We won't be able to recruit or keep good workers if things do not change. And that would be bad for our award-winning airport. We all know that everything in life has gone up over the last few years. Many of my coworkers, including myself, at the airport have kids, and we talk all the time about how much it costs us to provide for our families. Many airport workers have in the past relied on government health care for our families, especially kids. But now, many of us don't have access to that, meaning we don't afford any care for ourselves or our families. We are facing so much stress, especially this year, with people being taken by ICE, even though they are legally resided here. Everything feels hard, and we just want to be able to do our job assisting passengers and be able to pay our bills and afford our health care. It is wrong and unreasonable that the airport has so far refused act on this. But today, I'm thankful you are having this hearing and working to make sure the people who make MSP run smoothly can provide for our families. It is clear that nothing could happen at MSP International Airport without us, but you wouldn't know how we have been treated.
We'll need to have you wrap up if you can, sir.
We have been pushing this change for years, and we need action. We all want the airport to succeed, but if workers who make it run cannot afford to live or to be healthy, something needs change. Please vote yes today to support MSP airport workers. Other airports have done this, and it is time Minnesota step up and take the step here. Thank you so much for giving this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, and as you step away, if we have the following testifier, make you up to the front. But please, sir, if you can please identify yourself and proceed.
All right. I'm Nick Benson. Professionally, I own and operate a small business that does commercial flight data analytics, but lately I've been spending a lot of time at the airport at MSP, volunteering with Minnesota 5051, leading a team of volunteer observers who've been monitoring ICE Air deportation flights. I've personally witnessed dozens of these flights loading at MSP and have counted thousands of shackled people hobbling up the steps to take one last look at Minnesota, their home, before they're shipped off to a detention facility. I've spent hundreds of hours in and around MSP, and until this fall, I'd been pretty proud of it. For most passengers being loaded onto planes here, it's a good experience at a clean and beautiful facility because of the workers before you today. Minnesota 5051, SEIU 26, Unite Here, and faith groups have been taking a stand against ICE's actions at MSP and supporting airport workers who, despite doing things the right way and passing extensive background checks, have been snatched up by ICE on their way to work at MSP. Of course, neither the airport nor Delta have ever made any public comments about this, never mind a statement about how it was wrong. They can't even acknowledge that it happened. Instead, airport leadership told workers to call 911 if there was a safety concern, while also saying the airport police couldn't do anything. Credible solutions used by other airports to improve transparency at the airport have been dismissed. And it's obvious to me that they, MAC and Delta, are fine throwing their workers, our community, under the bus. Delta wasn't silent when it came to supporting the Big Beautiful Bill, which increased ICE's budget by 700%. Perhaps they were looking forward to the additional revenue from the kids they'd be flying down to San Antonio and the detention centers there. Perhaps it was the billions in tax savings. In any event, we have a chance to do right here by our airport workers in the Twin Cities by voting yes on this bill. MAC and Delta aren't going to do it unless we encourage them to. If employers can afford all of the wonderful lobbyists that you're going to hear from soon today, I'm confident they can afford to compensate their workers fairly. Vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for your testimony. So we'll have the next couple testifiers make your way up. And as I believe Kerry Warren's next, and so if you can please identify yourself and proceed, and if we can have all the testifiers as the next person is going, if you can just make your way up so we can keep things moving. Kerry Warren, welcome.
Thank you, Chairs Pinto and Baker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kerry Warren, and I serve as the Executive Director of the MSP Small Business Concessions Alliance, or MSBCA. MSBCA represents small women and minority-owned and operated businesses at MSP Airport and respectfully opposes House File 3878. As drafted, the proposal would set a new mandated wage and benefit floor for businesses operating at MSP and the reliever airports. MSP concession employers, like our members, already operate under a highly regulated, unique environment. The MAC currently oversees our wage, healthcare, and other benefit requirements through both our lease agreements and the RFP process upon which we are selected. They do this work well, and the impressive retention rates of our employees prove it. MSBCA members provide robust and varying benefit packages designed to meet the needs of their employees. Some airport workers, for example, prefer transit supplements, shift meals, parking, gym memberships, and even shoes over other offered benefits like health, vision, and dental insurance, which they may already have. This system of employee choice works well, and the proposed bill threatens benefit options our employees choose today. The proposal would also strongly advantage larger multinational companies that our members compete against for spaces at MSP. A floating wage and benefit floor changed annually makes cost certainty impossible. And competing against multinational companies who can afford to have a bad year, unlikely. Please keep in mind, the Commission caps what we can charge, so we cannot simply raise prices to adjust for increased labor costs. House File 3878 is certainly well-intentioned, and our members support the goal, but this proposal threatens our current benefit offerings and advantages larger operators over small, which puts further at risk realistic opportunities for small, women, and minority-owned businesses to compete at MSP and other Minnesota airports. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. B. Kyle, make your way up, and Mike Logan, if you can join at the table as well. And welcome, and please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto, Baker, and members of the committee. My name is B. Kyle. I'm the President and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber. We represent over 1,700 companies, employers, people within the East Metro counties of Washington, Ramsey, and Dakota. And several of our members are within the greater metropolitan area as well. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 3878 because of the very real impact it would have on the survivability of small employers, the competitiveness of our regional airport system, and the broader economy. Airports operate within a unique economic structure, and employers face high operating costs and significant lease obligations while simultaneously being locked into an artificially constrained pricing structure. When costs rise but prices cannot adjust accordingly, employers have very little room to absorb these increases. House File 3878 will add additional cost pressures in an already very burdened environment. Holman's Field in St. Paul, for example, is the MAC's primary reliever airport for the MSP. It's a popular base for corporate aircraft, home to two fixed base operators, Charter Services, a U.S. Customs facility, and the renowned Holman's Table, from whom you'll hear directly here later this morning. I mention this because the MAC airport system does not operate in a vacuum. Reliever airports such as Holman Field compete directly with other airports in the region. Tenants can easily move their operations to nearby airports such as Fleming Field and South St. Paul if operating costs become too high. Policies that make MAC airports more expensive risk pushing activity and jobs outside the system. The same dynamic exists at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. A recent MAC study shows MSP generates $21.3 billion in annual economic output. supports 93,000 jobs, contributes $3.3 billion in state and local tax revenues, and welcomed 4.7 million visitors who spent over $3 billion in Minnesota last year. Those numbers are not guaranteed. MSP relies heavily on connecting passengers to keep domestic and international routes viable. If operating costs rise, airlines have options. They can route those passengers through other hubs instead. And when that happens, those jobs, that tax revenue, and those visitors don't stay in Minnesota. Finally, MSP competes directly with major hub airports across the country. Airports in peer markets, both nationally and here in the Midwest, do not impose mandates like this. Policies that make MSP a cost outlier weaken the competitive position that has helped make it one of the most successful airports in the country. For those reasons, the St. Paul Area Chamber respectfully opposes House File 3878. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here. As the next testifier is about to begin, if Jeff Davidman, if you can make your way up to the testifier table. And I assume Mike Logan, if you can please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs Pinto, Baker, and members of the committee, including my representative, Representative Greenman. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony in opposition to House File 3878 today. My name is Mike Logan. I'm the president and CEO of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, and I'm here representing over 800 of our members, businesses across Hennepin County. The concerns that we as a business association have with this bill are many, but I'll name three quickly. First, this policy's desire to place yet another mandate on Minnesota businesses at a time when they're sorting through and paying for both earned sick and safe time as well as the new paid family medical leave program. The inability of employers to decide on their own benefit offerings for their employees leaves Minnesota businesses at a competitive disadvantage. Layer on rising operational costs and a high need for skilled workers, this policy will push these operators even closer to the edge, if not over it. Secondly, in 2024 alone, Minneapolis-St. Paul lost Spirit Airlines and JetBlue, while Frontier Airlines reduced their footprint as well. These departures are a clear indication of the precariousness that the MAC and its reliever airports find themselves in. Even interstate competitiveness will be affected, as this bill is oddly exclusive to simply MAC properties, leaving some operators the option to merely move shop to a non-affected airport, such as South St. Paul or even New Richmond. Scope further out the regional competitiveness between the Twin Cities and our peer cities, which B and I study a lot, such as Detroit, Denver, Salt Lake City, or Chicago, all of which have not seen this type of policy pass. Moving ahead with this bill would assuredly put MSP behind, and we could certainly see vendor departures across the MAC system. Third, and lastly, as a chamber, we're very concerned that this bill is less about affordable health care and more about special interests that will put the MAC facilities on an island in a competitive market. The last time this bill was introduced in 2024, the focus was to make sure that SEIU represented employees and their represented employees had affordable health insurance. Ironically, since that time, a new four-year contract has seen that health care premiums will drop by 30% during the contract. So instead of putting the burden on employers, we should be seeking to continue to lower the cost of actual care. Again, thank you for the time today to provide my testimony, and I hope that we at the Chamber can count on your no vote for this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And if Troy Redding can make your way to the front, Jeff Davidman, welcome, and please identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Davidman with Delta Airlines. I do appreciate the chance to be able to testify today. So Mike mentioned that this bill is here in 2024. This bill looks different this time, so just a quick overview of how we read it is that this bill now requires all employers at all MAC airports to follow the rules and regulations that are outlined in this. And so that would have an impact on the health insurance that Delta provides to our over 7,000 employees at MSP. Delta's success is rooted in the shared belief that taking care of our people empowers them to provide industry-leading care to our customers. Our success is 100% due to our incredible employees. They are truly the best airline professionals in the business, and it shows day in and day out with how they take care of our customers. To attract and retain professionals in the world, Delta has the best compensation and benefits package in the airline industry, such as industry-leading compensation, including shared rewards, which is a monthly award that we provide to our employees, as well as industry-leading profit sharing. Proud to say, for the ninth year out of the last 12 years, just last month, we provided over $1 billion in profit sharing to our employees around the world. That meant $114 million to our employees right here in Minnesota. That's equal to an additional 4 weeks of pay. We have comprehensive health coverage, including medical, dental, vision. plus family planning support, 401k with matching contributions, caregiving support, and much more that I don't have the time to outline today. These are just some of the examples of how Delta takes care of its employees, which has led Delta being named one of the top employers in the world by multiple organizations in the last 12 months that asked directly to our employees how we're doing. That includes Glassdoor, Fortune, Forbes, and People. With this background, I wanted to highlight the concerns with this bill as it applies, as I said, to all employees at the 7 MAC airports, including MSP. 5 years ago, Delta Airlines became the first airline to hire a chief health officer. The goal of this team is to elevate the health, the well-being of Delta employees and their families through benefits, resources, and services. Our team has done surveys, focus groups, one-on-one review, qualitative reviews, and other exercises with employees to better understand the needs of our employees when it comes to health care and to create a set of health and well-being benefits and offerings for Delta's employees that address their needs. One of our realizations is that there is not a one-plan-fits-all approach that works for 100,000 employees around the world. Therefore, we have to put together a variety of different choices that employees can choose from that best fit their needs and their families' needs. We provide these options because we engage directly with our employees to hear their concerns and provide options that work the best for them. And this is a continuous process.
I'll need to have you wrap up, I'm afraid, yes, if you can. Thanks.
I share all this background because even with all that work that we do and all the benefits that we provide to our employees, Delta's health insurance would not qualify, would not meet the requirements in this bill. If we were be required to comply with this legislation, it would add significant costs. And based on the work that we've done internally on this issue, we don't think it would provide a better care for our Delta employees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And if the last testifier make your way to the front, as Troy Redding, welcome to you. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, Chair Baker. Good morning, members. My name is Troy Redding, and I own and operate Holman's Table at Holman Field in St. Paul. Today, I'm here to try and give you a different perspective. I want to share my concerns about House File 3878, which would impact and quite, in fact, jeopardize my ability to continue to operate my business and continue to employ 55 people who work for me. If you haven't visited, we opened Holman's Table at the Mac-owned property in 2018. We created a dining experience that aims to celebrate the experience of travel, and in fact, we're the first restaurant in that space since 1997. Not only do we feed some of the passengers coming through the airport, but we are open to the public and proudly serve the community. This legislation concerns me because of the unanticipated costs associated with this bill. I independently own and operate Holman's Table and currently are subject to St. Paul wage requirements. It is important to take care of our workers. I am proud of the wages, benefits, and opportunities that I offer our employees. In addition to the newly mandated ESST and PMLF, I also offer medical, dental, vision insurance, fully paid mental health benefits, and a company match 401k program. To put it bluntly, this legislation would cause me to stop operating this business on the Mac property. When I take a hard look at my industry, we are struggling right now and are focused on keeping our doors open to serve the community and provide jobs. Restaurants across the Twin Cities are facing challenges worse than COVID, many of us down more than 50% over the past quarter. With decimated sales over the past few months, skyrocketing food costs, and ever-increasing mandated labor costs, it is virtually impossible to continue to operate. Another one-size-fits-all mandate on independently owned businesses just because they operate on Mac property is simply wrong. It is time to understand that small businesses need help, not mandates, to enable us to continue to care for our employees. I am asking you to oppose House File 3878, and happy for questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And then their final testifier, please identify yourself and proceed.
Michael Lawrence. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the general manager of Premier Jet Center. We're a privately owned small business at the Flying Cloud Airport, Eden Prairie. Flying Cloud Airport is a MAC, Metropolitan Airports Commission airport. We do not operate aircraft. We're a service center. We provide ground service for people who own and operate aircraft. Basically, we're a full-service gas station for airplanes. We employ many entry-level team members who are students in high school and college through internships and apprenticeships. while they're pursuing careers in the aviation industry, giving them experience and networking opportunities. To be clear, passage of this bill would eliminate those jobs and end that program. We compete with airports throughout the state and throughout the country. Every aircraft that comes to our facility comes from another airport, and they don't need to buy fuel from us. So this bill would put it as a competitive disadvantage, not only within the state, but throughout the country. The Service Contract Act was in place for businesses who choose to do government contract work. We don't do government contract work. That's not a business that we're interested in. And so I question why we should be singled out over other Minnesota businesses at other airports throughout the state, like Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, Brainerd, Bemidji, simply because we're on a MAC airport. Why should we be treated differently than any other Minnesota business in general that provides a service? Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's the final testifier to sign up in advance. And then any member of the public wishes to testify? Not seeing any, so we'll close testimony. Representative Schultz, you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just based upon the testimony, Representative Berg, this seems like a very broad piece of legislation, impacts a lot of folks. Surprised, in part, I know that we've heard this bill before in previous sessions, but surprised that we're still looking at one that encompasses multiple different airports rather than tailoring it potentially more towards MSP. But my biggest question for you, Representative Berg, is based upon my understanding of the bill, this impacts everyone who works at a MAC facility. And my question for you, Representative Berg, is doesn't this impact you personally?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. First of all, we are willing to make an amendment to just have it cover MSP totally and exclusively. And this does not include independent contractors, employees of the MAC, the federal government, state or local units of government, or executive, administrative, or professional employees. What impacts me personally? We heard from another testifier who talked about Delta's profit sharing, $114 million, I think that they're really proud of. The airline I work for is wholly owned by Delta, would absolutely love profit sharing, part of that $114 billion or million dollars, but we don't get that as a regional jet service. What we are talking about here are the workers that make the travel experience and my job possible. For example, they clean the airplanes. They load up the food. They push our passengers in wheelchairs to get them to the next destination. Sometimes they lift people out of a chair and into a seat with respect and with caring about the safety and comfort of those people. So does it affect my job personally? Yes, it does, because without them, I can't do my job.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just based upon everything that I've heard today, having read this bill and having been a part of this conversation, I think what I'm hearing is that this would be a direct conflict of interest, and that you potentially would benefit from this legislation if passed as written today.
And we can, Representative Berg, anything further you want to say to that point at this time?
Honestly, that's insane to say that somebody who works in the airport and pushes what could one day be your family member in a wheelchair to my plane so that I can serve them and take them to the next destination, which may be to visit family, that I somehow benefit from that. I can't even begin to answer that because it makes absolutely no sense. Do you think that I somehow make more money when passengers arrive in a wheelchair in a timely, respectful, and caring manner? I pass that question back to you.
And maybe we'll, Representative Schultz, anything further you want to take on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there's other questions around the table and we have limited time.
Okay. All right. Well, Chair Baker, to you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Berg, I think this is part of my question, because I want to make sure to the public it's clear to you, to protect you. If this bill were to pass today as you've written it and presented to us, will this, in fact, pay change for employees at MAC and MSP? Will that, in fact, change your rate? I need to, this is important for just the public awareness of our conflict of interest for all of us. I'm not trying to get you, but it's unusual to have an employee for a very small footprint carry a bill that improves the pay. It's not like you're asking for a minimum wage around the whole state. That's different. Just to get the clarity of this, is that in fact going to happen? If this bill were to pass, would your rate change?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Co-Chair Baker. I'm paid by an airline called Endeavor Air, wholly owned by Delta. These workers are not paid by Delta Airlines or Endeavor Air. What we are, there is absolutely zero correlation. I am not necessarily authoring this bill as a flight attendant, although that is my job. I am authoring this bill because I've spent 2.5 decades fighting for workers, and I will never stop. And to say I somehow would personally benefit from this, as if you need clarification, is offensive. We are talking about workers who do not have health care, but who also have sometimes dangerous jobs, depending on the weather elements or if equipment malfunctions. Look, I enjoy shoes, but I need health care. I don't even understand that one, but great. If you are married to somebody who has great health care, amazing. These are not the experiences of the workers we're talking about. We are centering the workers in this conversation, not my pay rate.
Mr. Chair Baker, again, yeah. I think this is important. And again, I want to make sure I thank the employees that are working so hard at MSP to make our airline terminals so amazing. I also want to thank the companies that invest so much money to make us what we are. So thank you for that. To answer the question, though, Representative Berg, it's either yes or no. Because we all care about conflict of interest, we all are branded by an elected official status that we have. When people come forward and it affects them personally, usually they step aside and let somebody else carry the bill. It's important for us, for transparency, which we all care about here. If this passed, would it or would it not affect your pay? We should know that, so we just understand it. That's my final question. Yes or no, please. Thank you.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. No, I don't know how to explain it any better that I am not paid by the same entity that they are paid by. I am fighting for workers. I am not increasing my pay. There is no correlation financially between this bill and what I do. The correlation is these workers make MSP run. Okay. So your gotcha question is ridiculous. Okay. We are not paid by the same company. What this does is advance the rights of workers. It does nothing to advance anything that I do.
But the employees at Holman Field, Mr. Chair, Holman Field and others don't work for the airline either. So I just want to make sure on the record, you've had a chance to explain it. You're not going to answer the question. I just want to make sure that we are all on this. So thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's been asked and answered no.
So Representative Greenman, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. If you had read the bill, if you look at 2.24 and you look at covered airport or related location workers, means any person employed to perform work at a covered employee at least half the time of the employee's time during any work week is performed at the covered airport. Flight attendants don't spend half their time or more at the covered airport. And the fact that you would make that accusation without reading the bill or asking nonpartisan staff, to me, is indicative. I don't think it's just about Representative Berg. I think it's you don't actually want to ask or listen to the workers who are here and just spent 20 minutes telling us about their work. Ad hominem attacks on our members do not change the fact that we have workers at our airports who, in the last 3 months, it's been tough on everyone. We've heard about businesses. It certainly has been tough on our black and brown workers. And the last few years have been. And so when we want to talk about the policy issues affecting us, one, let's be schooled in the bill. But two, let's actually address and respond to and listen to the workers. I feel like all too often this becomes a conversation about employers. And when workers come up, we ask, we distrust them. We ask if they're violating their contract. We ask if they're going to use the car for some illicit purpose. But we assume that workers are out, that employers, everything they do and anything that they do is inherently in the interest of everybody. And we know that's not true. We hear it from workers. So just thank you, Representative Burke. I used to represent the airport and the MAC. These workers, many of them have been fighting for years, not just for themselves, but for everybody in their community and their industry. And so at least we owe the dignity to address and respond to their stories and their concerns. This is a great bill. At some point soon, we should pass it, and I hope you'll do it with us.
Representative Hussein, to you.
Thank you for bringing this bill.
We're tight on time, just a reminder. Thank you.
Say it again?
Said just we're tight on time, but I want to make
all
sure
right,
you get a chance to speak.
Thank you very much for allowing me. And I just want to share personal information. I used to work at the airport. I used to be 20 years ago, and this job was not easy. If airport get delayed, it's a peer pressure that you're cleaning the job. I mean, you know, you have to run into one airplane to another airplane, and with no benefit, with no time off, with no health care. And we was the one making sure that Delta would not get any delay. And we were cleaning the airport, and we were cleaning the airplanes and making sure that food is in there, napkins in there, all the equipment, safety box, you name it. And the many people that was working is an immigrant and still is, and those people are coming here for dignity and asking for fair wage and health care so they can continue and take care for their healthy and take care of their families. And I don't see why we should not support this bill. Our airport workers do important jobs every day to keep our airport safe and run well. This bill helps make sure that they receive a fair wage and affordable health care. Also, they can take care of themselves and take care of their family members. The job that they do is not an easy job. It's a timely seconds. You have to be in and out within less than 15 minutes or maybe 5 minutes so that airport cannot be delayed. Multiple people. So I don't know what else to say, but, you know, we got a lot of testifies, and I want to say thank you for all of you for coming forward and to share your stories. We should not deny people when they ask and ask for fair wage so they can take care of it, their families, they can take care of her, for place for them to leave. I mean, everything's very expensive. Food are expensive. Gas is expensive. Rental place are expensive. So all they asking is dignity and asking for fair wage. This bill will transform for those people that came forward and asking for support. So shame on for those people that not supporting. I mean, Delta making billions of dollars off those people that are working day and night. We used to run zero blow, minus outside, making sure that this has been taken care of so they can keep flying throughout the 50 states. I'm very emotional. After 20 years or over two decades, people are still asking the same thing that they keep coming back to this committee and asking for fair wage so they can take care of their loved ones. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hussein, and thank you, Representative Berg. I represent the district right across from the airport and have many folks who work there and my constituents and work incredibly hard. This bill is going to be laid over for now to allow some more further conversation, but I expect it to come back up. Hold on a second, though. Representative Berg, you get the final word.
thank you so much. Minnesota would not be alone in passing this bill. New York, New Jersey, and at least a dozen other airports across this country already do this. I think Rep. Hussein did a great job of closing remarks, but I will say this. It is telling that the only argument from the other side on this bill was an attack on me and my job. You have no better argument than attack me for fighting for our workers. Pilots are excluded. Flight attendants are excluded. The only time I spend in the airport is walking to and from a plane and maybe a break. That is not 50% of my time on the job. You admitted in this hearing already, Representative Baker, pardon me, Chair Baker, that the Greenman bill benefited you. But now you are asking me if fighting for these workers benefits me. That's your argument. I think that tells us everything we need to know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, the chair lays over House File 3878 as amended. We're back on at 8:15 tomorrow. With that, this meeting is adjourned.